Good afternoon. I'm A.E. Dick Howard. I'm White Burkett Miller Professor of Law and Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm delighted to welcome you to the, what I regret to say is the last session in what has been an intensely stimulating conference on Polish, American, and French constitutional trends. It's been a wonderful affair. We are deeply indebted to Blanka Rosenstiel. May I say that, though others have already said it, I wish to add my thanks to others for being so wonderfully supportive of this enterprise. And I know I reflect the appreciation of speakers, discussants, and others who've been involved in the fine support of Ken Thompson, who's at the back of the other room. Ken, as you know, is director of the Miller Center, and this is, for him, simply one more such enterprise of sharing the world of ideas with a larger public. This one, I think, has been unusually good. This afternoon, we will be talking about American influences on human rights. We will be setting aside ample time, we hope, in this session for comments and questions from people who are here. My colleagues and I will try to be mercifully brief in our opening remarks so that we can be fairly democratic during this session. And I would say, by way of ground rules, that I'd be happy for people who have questions that have flowed from other sessions, if they think this is an appropriate time to raise those. I think Ken Thompson would agree with me that, as the last session, this is the appropriate vehicle to do a little summing up and putting a cap on the whole affair. Let me, before I make a remark or two to open up, let me first introduce my two colleagues who will be taking part in the panel this afternoon. To my left, Richard Lilick, who is a chaired professor at the University of Virginia's Law School, well known in international law and human rights circles. He will make the first comments after mine. And then to my right, David Martin, also professor of law at the University of Virginia, also has quite a reputation in human rights affairs. We have chosen two of our best from a very strong faculty, so I think we've got a treat in store this afternoon. In thinking about the afternoon's topic, it struck me that I might say a word at the outset about the question of how constitutional ideas travel, how they get around, because we are celebrating in this country, in France, and in Poland, in effect, a bicentennial era. We are looking at 200 years of constitutional evolution in which, though constitutions clearly have their roots in the culture, the history, the mores and customs of the respective countries, there is what I would call an international traffic in constitutional ideas. That countries do borrow from each other. They sometimes borrow heavily. There's certainly a great awareness of the comparative dimension of constitutionalism. There was in the 18th century, and there certainly is today. It strikes me that there are three ways, let me at least suggest three ways, a Trinitarian approach to the subject, three ways that constitutional ideas get around. One is through colonial, imperial, or other modes of influence or power, namely that a large power has colonized or otherwise occupied another territory and has either imposed or planted, as the case may be, some kind of constitutional system. I would give as examples Great Britain's leaving behind the Westminster model as it sought to implant in African countries newly independent starting in the 1960s. As an example of imposition, I would give the Stalinist constitutions, which were imposed in countries within the Soviet sphere of influence. For example, the present Hungarian constitution, the one adopted after World War II, is clearly derivative of the Soviet constitution of 1936. One could give the example of the constitution which the Philippines adopted in 1936, the one that was recently, 2 years ago, superseded. That constitution was virtually a carbon copy of the U.S. Constitution, the Philippines, of course, being at that time an American colony. And finally, I would give the examples of the West German and Japanese post-World War II constitutions whose origins the American influence is obvious. Secondly, I would offer as a way in which constitutional ideas get around those that arise from some admiration for another country's social or political or economic arrangements. That is to say, the Constitution has not been imposed or left behind by a colonizing or imperial power, but it simply arises from the fact that the country from which it originates is thought to have achieved something by way of the good life, which the country doing the borrowing aspires to. Not all of these efforts to borrow succeed. I would offer as an example the Latin American countries' efforts in the early 19th century to virtually copy the U.S. Constitution. The admiration of South American liberals of that period for the American achievement was manifest, and they simply borrowed wholesale the American Constitution, largely without great success. There's some interesting variations on this theme. I was in France over spring vacation giving a paper, and while there I talked to Robert Badinter, who's the presiding judge of the Constitutional Court in Paris, and he told me the story of an American who was standing nearby as the Parisian mobs were sacking the Tuileries Palace, and they were tossing furniture and books and other things out of the windows. And as he watched this scene, suddenly a book hit this American on the head. And he picked the book up, and it was a bound copy of the Pennsylvania Constitution of 1776. A rather concrete example of American influence abroad. And it's interesting that was the Constitution, because the French, in fact, did admire Pennsylvania's 1776 Constitution, which was the most democratic of the first American constitutions, one not unlike the one that the French themselves adopted in 1791. Another conversation I had last year was with a friend from Argentina who told me a story, I had not heard this before, of how the great 19th century Argentine jurist, Alberti, the architect of Argentina's 19th century constitution, was influenced by, of all things, California's constitution of 1850, because the Argentines, who were then setting out on development of their country, thought the Californians were the example of prosperity and laissez-faire and exploration, and that if they simply adopted some ideas from the California Constitution, they too could be a prosperous country. Well, I could give other examples, but I think you get the drift that people see something good happening somewhere else and they borrow those ideas. Finally, and here I anticipate what I suspect Richard Lilick and David Martin will have to say, I think there's a mode of borrowing which is not simply an imitation of one country or necessarily an appreciation of any one place, but rather a tradition that flows from universally shared aspirations, certain values that seem not to know any national frontiers. Clearly, this was the mode of thought in the age of the Enlightenment, when Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin were in Paris and wrote back about the exciting events beginning in July of 1789. Americans like that were struck by the way the French appeared to be acting upon the advice of the French philosopher Condorcet, who referred to there being a common core of human happiness, the age of reason notion that if you simply stripped away the national and superficial differences from one country to another, at the core you would find human beings aspiring to the same basic goals. And that ought to be the job of a constitution maker, to try to reflect aspirations of that kind. It was, of course, natural law or natural rights thinking, and it was so widespread that you can read tracts by philosophers strikingly different in other respects, John Locke, Thomas Hobbes, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and others. And even though they arrive at very different conclusions, they use the same analytical modes of, of thinking, natural rights, the social compact, and so forth. Today's reflection of that, I think, is the way that certain words like democracy and rights are universally used, just as constitutions are virtually universally written. We all know, of course, that those words mean very different things in the hands of different regimes and different systems, but there is an enormous power that those ideas have, such things as rights and constitutionalism. Finally, a word about American influence. That is one of our themes this afternoon. It seems to me that the American influence in other parts of the world was very strong in the 18th century, when the American experiment was closely watched throughout the civilized world, and events here were followed with great and avid interest, especially in Western Europe. The American influence is a great deal less obvious than the 19th century. It seems to me that as one moves into the post-Napoleonic era in Europe, into the age after 1815, when the great powers imposed their settlement upon the continent, which in turn gave rise to nationalistic impulses, for example, in the revolutions of 1848, it seems to me that constitution makers, especially in Europe, tended not to look to the American model that much. I think they were more influenced by intermediate models such as the Belgian Constitution of 1830. But once again, these things have a certain dialectical pattern. In the 20th century, once again, the American experience is much more at the fore, it seems to me, especially since World War II, partly because of America's enhanced interest in the international scene since 1945, partly because of the prosperity of America in the first half of the 20th century. Partly, I would submit, though this might be difficult to document, partly because of the rising interest in this country domestically in civil rights and civil liberties. When the Supreme Court in 1954 decided Brown versus Board of Education, striking down racial segregation in public education, that of course was an application of the American Constitution to American conditions. But the moral impact of the Brown case was bound to be felt abroad as it was in this country. I'm not suggesting that America's track record is unblemished. We all know examples of repressions and discriminations and others at any point in this country's history. But I think as nations go and as experiences of various countries go from one part of the world to another, at least the American aspiration through its constitution has tended to be something that others have sought to imitate. That's far too brief an opening, but I did want to share with you a few thoughts at the beginning. All they do is edge me up to, but I stop just short of the terrain that my colleague Richard Lilick will embark upon, so I'm delighted, therefore, to turn the two microphones over to him. We think his ideas are twice as good as most people's, and therefore he gets two microphones. Richard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Howard. First of all, let me apologize for not attending your sessions the last 2 days. Just so happens that I have my schedule organized, so I teach all my classes, 6 class hours on Monday and Tuesday, and so not only have I been busy during the days, but I've actually had seminars in the evenings that have prevented me from attending any of the dinners here. But the topic is a topic of great interest to me, and I would like to add perhaps another dimension, develop some of the points that Mr. Howard has mentioned with respect to this rather interesting phenomena, which I find to be a growing phenomenon of legal transplants. You used the word transplants. As you know, several years ago, our then colleague visiting from the University of Edinburgh wrote a book called Legal Transplants. We found out many years later that it was filed in the library when we couldn't find it under medical law. But he was a comparative lawyer. He was a Roman lawyer. And as a result of his development of this thesis on how different legal systems have had other legal systems impacting upon them, I became interested in the topic myself. And indeed, just last night I found out something that I probably should have known, that the Japanese commercial code, of course, is the German commercial code, and therefore if you wish to attach Iranian assets, you can use the provision in Japan just like you can use the provision in Germany. Now, I have a 54-page speech here.
And now to my colleague, David Martin.
Mr. Howard said that he was going to talk 5 minutes, and he talked 15. I won't talk a half hour. In fact, I won't even talk from this speech. It's here, I suppose, as a security blanket. I will tell one little anecdote about these prepared speeches that some of you perhaps have heard, but it was a real-life anecdote, and I was there to hear it. It involved General Eisenhower, as he then was, campaigning during the 1952 campaign. As an erstwhile newspaper man, I followed the general around northern Ohio from time to time and listened to several of his speeches. He had less of an ability to deliver a prepared speech than even the present holder of the office, I think, has, and he was very, very anxious whenever possible to get away from a prepared speech. And his speechwriters would prepare all his speeches, as some of you may recall, and then quite frequently at the big rallies he'd come in and say, "You don't want to listen to this," and throw it away, and he'd ramble on about something. I was there the night listening to him talk in Cleveland the night of Nixon's speech, and he came out and ad-lib what I thought was one of his more effective speeches, in which he said he'd rather have one man with courage than a whole boxcar full of pussyfooters, which obviously was not ghost-written for him. It's an old Kansas expression. But as a result of throwing away these speeches after 2 months, you may imagine that the speechwriters were a little less than enthusiastic of preparing a new speech about communism or Korea or capitalism or communism or something like that. And one night, apparently, a speechwriter wrote 3 pages here. The general never read his speeches before he got up there. And he decided he actually was going to read the speech because it was on economic policy or something he knew nothing about. So he read page 1, read page 2, read page 3, came to page 4, blank page. Came to page 5, it was a blank page. He thought, you know, this is before Xeroxing, of course, but he thought the mimeograph machine might have missed. Turned to page 6, and on it was written in handwriting, "Ad lib, you son of a bitch." So, I have 54 pages, and now I'm going to ad lib. But I'm a nice guy. I would like to add a slightly different dimension to retrace a few things that Mr. Howard said, but also go ahead and discuss the impact of U.S. constitutional law, not only on the constitutional law of other countries, but on international human rights law as well. Because I find increasingly that there is, in effect, a synthesis between constitutional law in all countries, or not all countries, but potentially all countries, in a good many countries, and constitutional law in the U.S., and that international human rights law, at least in certain areas now, is so universally accepted that it's having an impact on the law elsewhere. And we can find this, as I will give you examples a little bit later on, and as Dick has pointed out, in the constitutions of a good many countries. He mentioned the Westminster model, but it is not unsurprising that in the African countries and now in the Caribbean countries, you find, in effect, the European Convention on Human Rights, to which, as I will turn in just a moment, the U.S. Constitution had a substantial role to play in its development. The European Convention writ into the constitution of a particular Commonwealth country as part of their Bill of Rights. Somewhat ironic because, of course, as you know, under the Thatcher government and under the preceding governments in the United Kingdom, they will not themselves adopt the European Convention as part of domestic British law. Lord Scarman, who was here at the law school several years ago, was one of them and gave an excellent speech on this topic, has been one of the leading proponents for institutionalizing domestically the European Convention of Human Rights as constitutional law in Great Britain. But apparently what's good enough for the natives in Jamaica or in Zimbabwe is not good enough, or perhaps too good, for the inhabitants of Manchester or parts of Lancaster. And so the British have not adopted what they have, in effect, required as the condition of independence in many of their African and Caribbean countries. And as a result, one will find, and this is very ironic, particularly in the more enlightened of these Commonwealth countries, jurisprudence that is now far more advanced than jurisprudence from the House of Lords and the Privy Council, and indeed, to some extent, perhaps even from our Supreme Court. But I was asked to talk a little about the impact of the U.S. Constitution upon other constitutions, and I thought I would do that using the framework of international human rights law. American constitutional lawyers, of course, over and over have made the point that, and American politicians, that enlightened jurisprudence elsewhere has a lot to thank American constitutional law. I think the three periods that Dick talked about, the period of our revolution, rather dearth in the 19th century, I think it's fair to say, and then in the last, particularly the last 30 or 40 years or so, in the court's activist approach towards the Bill of Rights protection, a real contribution elsewhere. But this is something, of course, that's been a ordinary matter, of course, at least on an individual basis, between judges on the Supreme Court, Holmes, and English judges like Pollock over the years. What I find interesting is it's becoming to some extent, or was becoming to some extent, institutionalized. Brown against Board of Education may be an example of how the U.S. contributed to the norm of non-discrimination in the area, the international norm of non-discrimination in the area of racial segregation. But ironically, of course, the UN Charter, with its provision on non-discrimination in general, which was adopted as a treaty and therefore the supreme law of our land 9 years before Brown against Board of Education, had a substantial impact upon that decision. So it indicates that even at the time when our court perhaps became more active in the constitutional area, suggesting avenues of approach for other countries, we were drawing upon international sources. And frankly, I have no time today, and literally I have no time or patience with American constitutional lawyers who spend all the time patting the United States on the back. Our Constitution has made a contribution, as we know. Why go on? Let's talk about what contribution our Constitution is now making. And as we'll see in a good many areas, dealing with sexism, sexual preferences, abortion, and what have you, the Europeans certainly are well ahead of the United States, and in many areas international human rights law is ahead of the United States as well. So I have about 4 or 5 pages here from all kinds of distinguished scholars like Professor Henkin of Columbia, and Anthony Lester, the great British barrister, about how great the American Constitution was. Professor Henkin, for instance, says Americans were prominent among the architects and builders of human rights. American constitutionalism was a principal inspiration and model for them, etc., etc. But I'll just take that for a given and go on and say, you know, we built a good house, a good framework here. How are we decorating that house? How are we, in effect, filling out what we've originally built? And I think we have done this, at least potentially, through our contribution to the development of international human rights norms. As you, of course, I would presume all know, Eleanor Roosevelt was the first chairman of the Human Rights Commission. President Truman in 1946 didn't know what to do with her. There she was. And they thought they would send her to the United Nations, as has occurred to other people from time to time, keep them out of trouble. She was elected, of course, president of the Human Rights Commission. And as we know, within 2 years, with a little help from her friends and from some very distinguished American lawyers, as well as some distinguished continental lawyers, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted. Now, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, although it focuses basically upon civil and political rights and doesn't take up economic and social and cultural rights, which are greatly emphasized in some quarters today, much less the third generation of international human rights, such as peace, disarmament, and things like that, is a very, very remarkable document, and a document that we all should be proud of, in the U.S. particularly, because of the contribution it made. And that document, through this international legal transplant process, has found its way not only into a host of other international instruments, but also into a lot of constitutions, as I alluded to before. Let me just give you the example. The Universal Declaration was adopted in 48. In the early 1950s, the Europeans, in 1950 actually, the Europeans signed the European Convention on Human Rights. And that, in effect, was taken almost lock, stock, and barrel, with a few more conservative tinges from the Universal Declaration. In turn, the European Convention was utilized along with the Universal Declaration when the UN adopted in 1966 the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. And during all this period, of course, as during the late 50s and early 60s, Great Britain and France were liberating or freeing their African colonies, in those former colonies, provisions from the Universal Declaration and provisions from the European Convention were, in effect, being incorporated in bills of rights. And so, therefore, either directly or indirectly through international human rights law, one can find a tremendous synthesis here. You can call it constitutional law, but it's international law, and it makes it very interesting. One of the areas of my sub-areas of interest is Indian law. The Indian Constitution, its Bill of Rights, is taken from the Civil and Political Covenant. And so, to answer a new legal question, when it's presented to the Indian Supreme Court, they can look to the decisions of the Human Rights Committee under the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. They can look to the decisions of the Human Rights Commission and its subcommission insofar as an interpretation of the Universal Declaration. They can look to the human rights other human rights organs of the other regional organizations such as the Inter-American Commission that have the same text almost in hic verba in some of their provisions as well. And, of course, they can look at the decisions of other Supreme Courts, other courts of appeals in other states that are interpreting through their constitutional framework the same kind of language. So what we're getting now, and this has just started in a series of reports by the Commonwealth Center in London, and will be developed, I think, in another 2 years by a series of annual reports dealing with human rights and constitutional law cases, is the fact that the same standards now are really becoming truly universal and being interpreted. And one cannot just look at another country like the U.S. for many years looked to England to get its constitutional jurisprudence. One cannot just look to the European Court of Human Rights to get ideas about how to interpret language, but one has to cast one's net quite farther. And I've developed this in some detail here, and I, because of time limits, won't go on to it in much more detail, but I'd like to give you one example of how this has had a substantial impact, and then I will go to my final remarks about what we in the U.S. should be doing with respect to all these developments now. Because what we're talking about here, if we're talking about universal standards, is a two-way trade in human rights. It's not just us exporting anymore our ideas about basic human rights. It's the extent to which we are going to import some of those rights from some of the other countries and the other organs that have been interpreting them. And let me just give you an example here of a case that was recently decided, Nukubi against the state, by the Supreme Court of Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe is another sub-area of interest to me, and I look forward to going back there and talking with some of the members of the court this coming month. They have a provision in Article 15 of their Constitution, in their Bill of Rights, that one should not be subjected to inhuman or degrading treatment or punishment. Now, that language comes from the Universal Declaration. It's been incorporated in the Civil Political Covenant, in the European Convention, in the American Convention on Human Rights, and many people argue that it's actually part of customary international law. But, of course, it requires, like equal protection or due process or any of the other general standards in the U.S. Constitution, interpretation. And the case that arose was a case that the U.S. is not unfamiliar with, namely corporal punishment, the whipping of offenders, which, of course, was quite common in Zimbabwe before 1968 and has continued thereafter. And the Supreme Court was faced with this question, whether seven strokes was, in effect, inhuman and degrading punishment in violation of the Constitution. Now, Judge Gouboy, who was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, how did he approach this? And it's an interesting construct to see how judges in countries that have the opportunity to do this, and I would suggest judges in the United States as well don't have that great opportunity because, of course, we don't have a provision like this directly in our Constitution. We do have the Eighth Amendment, but it doesn't cover quite the wide area that this provision does. And, of course, as you know, we're parties to none of the basic international human rights instruments so that we would not be able to look to the international law directly in applying and developing a standard here. What did he look at? First of all, he surveyed the law of Australia, Canada, Great Britain, and the United States, as well as the law of a good many countries as well. In fact, he paid, and I quote, special attention to the attitudes and expressions emanating from the distinguished justices of the Supreme Court of the United States. I've said my nice things about the United States, referred to Trope against Dulles, Estelle against Gamble for those constitutional lawyers. And then he borrowed all of these, including decisions of the European Court on Human Rights, to find that Article 15 of their Constitution prohibited punishments of this nature, despite the fact that the Mugabe government of Zimbabwe was arguing to the contrary, that this inflicted unnecessary and wanton infliction of pain and therefore it was repugnant to the constitutional things. As I said, he cited decisions of the European Convention, and ironically, of course, the decisions under the European Convention, ironically, of course, this issue has arose in England three times because they still have corporal punishment in Scottish schools and on the Isle of Man and what have you, and although they've been held to be in violation of the European Convention, they have not yet changed their law in this regard. So it's somewhat ironic, and Judge Gouboy points out that corporal punishment has been much less exercised in Zimbabwe in the last 8-9 years, which of course are coextensive with the disappearance of the Smith regime. He doesn't go on to point out that you still have this in England, and therefore, to some extent, the Zimbabwean decision here, foisting the European Convention upon them in this constitutional transplant, has resulted where I would suggest, and I'm sure that Lord Scarman would agree, that England has a little bit to learn from Zimbabwe. Perhaps the United States has a little to learn as well. Now let me turn to the second half of my remarks, because I have now taken almost my 18, 20 minutes, but let me just say it in 3 minutes about the use of some of these norms in the United States. First of all, as I've suggested, we are, of course, not a party to any of the human rights, major human rights treaties. We are a party, as Mr. Martin well knows, because he's an expert in this area, to the Refugees Protocol, and through the Refugees Protocol, subscribe to the provisions in the Refugees Convention. But we've repudiated all of these. They not repudiated them, but the Senate has not seriously considered them. Took a long time, as we know, for the Genocide Convention to get ratified. It was only ratified by the United States last October with a disgusting number of reservations and declarations that undercut the the entire convention, a very disgraceful performance in my estimation. So the United States cannot, and the Supreme Court or other courts cannot, look to international human rights law via the treaty route. Treaties, of course, are the supreme law of the land pursuant to the Constitution, and therefore, if these treaties were adopted by the United States, the possibility of looking at them as self-executing treaties, treaties that have the force of domestic law and are readily applicable, a doctrine that goes back to Chief Justice Marshall, that would be available. But we're not party to them, so that we can't do that. Many of us have been arguing over the last decade or so that some of these international treaties have become so accepted universally that they have become part of customary international law. Customary international law under the Constitution, under a 1900 case called the Boquete-Habana, has been deemed by the Supreme Court to be part of our law and therefore applicable in a given case. And in a series of cases, testimony has been given and briefs have been written that the United States should adopt these human rights norms via the customary international route, and in some cases that has been held to be true. Torture has been held to be a violation of customary international law in the United States. Arbitrary detention has been held to be a violation of customary international law. But nevertheless, particularly since the Reagan administration the last several years intervened in several cases in which the government, well, not intervened because the government was a defendant in several cases in which people had been arbitrarily detained for a period of 7 or 8 years, and justified that arbitrary detention under other technical provisions of U.S. law, and therefore cut off this kind of development, at least in the area of arbitrary detention. So it's problematical about how far we can go, and in any event, going that route to some extent is not the proper way to go. The treaty route is the way to go, and at least in my estimation, the U.S. should confront this and ratify a few of these treaties that many of the other countries that we frequently criticize have ratified. And so what way is available to the U.S. and to the Supreme Court absent either of these other alternatives of treaties or customary international law? Well, one interesting development that probably Mr. Howard knows much more about than I do is the fact that the court in general, in interpreting some of the general terminology of statutes and of constitutional provisions, has looked to what it calls the enlightened jurisprudence, and that in law of community standards. And the question is, what is the ambit of those community standards? This has arisen in recent years in a whole series, for instance, of prison cases in which the treatment of prisoners has been deemed to, at least in the view of some people, to offend contemporary community standards and therefore constitute treatment and punishment in violation of the Eighth Amendment. And this kind of infusion of these standards into constitutional law has been a very interesting development. And one thing that I and some of my colleagues that have appeared in some of these cases have attempted to do is have the courts broaden their horizon to look not only at contemporary standards, what the County Sheriff's Association, what the Association of Law Enforcement Officers has been recommending about prison conditions. Because ironically, just as we find in the gun legislation area now, it's law enforcement officers that are for better prison conditions. They want more jails, of course, in Washington. They want more facilities in New York and what have you. It's the public, of course, that doesn't provide them. But I've been suggesting, and a good many of my colleagues have been suggesting, that you go beyond looking at contemporary standards in the context of the United States and look at international contemporary standards. And indeed, the Supreme Court has done that. They did it in many minor cases during the late 1940s and 1950s. But quite recently, they've done it in several major cases. And indeed, in one recent case, the Thompson case last year, a death penalty case, Sandra Day O'Connor, as well as Mr. Justice Stevens for a plurality opinion, so you had a majority, I think it was five or six of judges of the court, indicated that they were prepared, at least by the citations, to go to these international standards to provide some content as to whether it was cruel and unusual punishment to execute a teenage boy. And I think that's a useful approach. I should say that what one would call perhaps a preemptive strike was laid down in the Thompson case by our good friend and my former tennis partner, Mr. Justice Scalia, or Justice Scalia as we now say, when in that case he indicated and underscored in a footnote that the United States should only look at United States standards. It seems to me that this is exact wrong approach. It's exactly contrary to everything that's going on anywhere in the country. I would think that any Supreme Court justice, if they could look to Zimbabwe to get some enlightened help, should do so. I've already talked too long, but I'll be glad to answer questions.
Thank you. I turn now for further commentary to Professor David Martin of the University of Virginia's Law Faculty.
Thank you very much. I do not have a 54-page text. I suffer from the same temptations that many law faculty do to go on at some length about topics that are of interest. I'll do my best to curb that and keep this very brief. What I thought I might try to do, not having a prepared text as such, would be to try to tie this particular topic into some of the themes that have permeated our consideration over the length of this conference. And one that strikes me initially, and I think may raise some skepticism about the whole topic of international human rights law, is one that I've heard referred to at many points, including already this afternoon, the importance of political culture. Development of constitutions in each of the countries we've looked at, indeed in each country around the world, has of course been influenced greatly by the political and social context in which it is framed. Now, if we take that lesson in its strongest form, we might well conclude that any effort regarding international human rights norms is utopian, perhaps faintly ridiculous, in any event doomed to failure. And of course, one hears this kind of charge frequently. I think also sometimes those of my colleagues who spend a lot of time worrying about major strategic issues, geopolitical issues, also tend to suggest that human rights concerns are something of a sidelight, and really what's more important is the hard-nosed content of developing politics. Those are important and strong charges, and one that I think one needs to focus on directly. Taken from the standpoint of those who focus on the intricacies of particular political cultures, this effort to craft international human rights norms is either going to have to go to such a level of abstraction as to have no real content, to permit people from a variety of cultures to read into those norms virtually anything that they want to read into it, or else it's going to have to be manifested in documents that are merely declaratory, that have no enforcement mechanisms and therefore can perhaps be ignored. This is the kind of charge that one frequently hears. Or beyond that, just I was having a conversation before this session with my friend Professor Fernbach, and he pointed out, yes, there's a lot of law that nobody listens to, and that's exactly the case, and that's a problem that plagues the international human rights field. Well, both of these problems that I mentioned, that problem of exaggerated abstraction, the problem of lack of enforcement, appear in the human rights area. But I would suggest that those difficulties are not as disabling as many of the critics suggest. And I'd like to focus, first of all, on the question of enforcement mechanisms, provide a bit of a story about the development of some of the international human rights norms, particularly the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which my colleague, Professor Lilick, referred earlier. Now, I have a copy of it here. Don't leave home without it. It lists 30 articles of a variety of norms, many of which contain a great many parallels to the Bill of Rights in the United States, and several of the provisions go far beyond that. There were high hopes in 1945 as plans were being made for a new organization, a new United Nations to be set up in a charter. There were high hopes in many quarters for detailed human rights provisions in that sort of a treaty, in the United Nations Charter. It reflected a reemergence of some natural rights thinking, to which Dick Howard referred earlier, some thinking that seemed to have been submerged in a positivist tide for many previous decades, but some thinking that reemerged in revulsion, in horror, at what had been done by Nazi Germany. The thinking was there must be some kinds of standards that allow us to condemn this, something other than simply the elements of positive law. In any event, that natural rights thinking gave rise to several hopes that there may be strong human rights provisions in the United Nations Charter, and perhaps then with specific mandates to enforce those provisions through the United Nations machinery. Instead, what emerged in the UN Charter were some very general references. Now, they did have a specific non-discrimination norm, to which Richard Lilic referred earlier, but beyond that, it was simply a general reference to human rights and fundamental freedoms. Some of those who were disappointed were met with a response from some of the governmental officials, including President Truman at the time, who said, well, but we have created a human rights commission in Article 68, and the first business of that commission will be to draft an international Bill of Rights. Now, that, too, sounds like something, a Bill of Rights. It sounds like something that has real enforcement teeth. Instead, what initially emerged through the efforts of Eleanor Roosevelt and many others was a declaration adopted as such by the UN General Assembly. It was a declaration and not a treaty. It did not set forth an enforcement mechanism. And this, too, was a cause of great disappointment to some who had had high hopes for international human rights efforts. In fact, it seemed to be the price of adoption of the of this document that people reassured governments that it really had no enforcement content at all. Eleanor Roosevelt said at one point, and I quote, "It is not a treaty. It is not an international agreement. It is not and does not purport to be a statement of law or legal obligation." In fact, in the Commission's debates in the UN Human Rights Commission, she had had to go so far as to say that the declaration had, quote, no juridical value. Now, it's not surprising that some people then thought this was merely an exercise in hypocrisy, and many of the supporters of human rights were deeply disappointed that it was merely a declaration. Now, I'd like to suggest, though, that we take a somewhat longer-term view and understand the value of statements, even of this kind, that are merely declaratory. And particularly, I think, meeting in this particular setting, we should understand that. I came across a commentary on the value and effectiveness of declarations, human rights declarations, by a longtime student of the subject who'd been active in several human rights struggles. And he wrote, or actually was part of a speech, "They," referring to the declaration's framers, "meant simply to declare the right so that enforcement of it might follow as fast as constantly looked to, constantly labored for, and even though never perfectly attained, constantly approximated, and thereby constantly spreading and deepening its influence and augmenting the happiness and value of life to people of all colors everywhere." Now, those words sound like they fit 1948, the time of the adoption of the Universal Declaration, very well. In fact, in the preamble to the Universal Declaration, they talk about a common standard of achievement, and here this writer is talking about a standard maxim for free society. The commentator, though, is Abraham Lincoln. He was speaking in 1857 in Springfield, Illinois, and he was talking about the American Declaration of Independence around the time of its 80th anniversary, not that much longer than the amount of time we've seen transpire since the Declaration, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted. And there's some human rights provisions in the American Declaration of Human Rights, which also looked pretty hypocritical in 1776. Lincoln had this to say about that. The assertion that all men are created equal was of no practical use in effecting our separation from Great Britain, and it was placed in the Declaration not for that, but for future use. Its authors meant it to be, as thank God it is now proving itself, a stumbling block to all those who, in after times, might seek to turn a free people back into the hateful paths of despotism. So the words are there for future use. And I think, as Lincoln understood very well, words subscribed to solemnly, even in a document with no immediate enforcement mechanism, afford a very important fulcrum for later political efforts to make those standards be realized. Now, Lincoln, in fact, used the Declaration, the words of the Declaration, very effectively throughout his career, and eventually he was in a position, of course, to help translate those into law. It took over 47 years, add about 5 years to that, before it was embodied in the Constitution. And of course, that wasn't the end of the process. It took perhaps another 47 before the courts began to become really serious in the 1950s about helping to enforce those particular provisions. So it takes time for those kinds of provisions to be realized. It takes difficult political efforts. And it takes, and there's nothing automatic about it, I should add. Someone spoke, I think it was Professor Ludwikowski, spoke of a spreading constitutional consciousness, which he spoke of, talking about an awareness that governmental power should be limited. And that, and people, in speaking about that that afternoon, talked about how that emerges and develops over time. Well, I think that kind of a consciousness is emerging now in many political cultures. I do think, though, that the process is fostered and can be speeded up by the availability of international instruments and the kinds of associations that can be built around those international instruments, even, I would say, even if the provisions are highly general. One example of that, making effective use of a particular part of our culture, would be the concert sponsored over this past summer by Amnesty International as part of their Human Rights Now campaign, tapping in very much to the extensive unifying cultural influence of rock music to begin to get the message out in a wide variety of cultures about international human rights. It was handed out at each of those concerts in a variety of languages, documents that list these rights, and just to begin to get people within their own political context to think, yes, these are rights which I have. The UN has solemnly declared I'm entitled to this. My constitutional consciousness may perhaps grow, my idea that government should be limited. Now, I think that's the kind of process that we're involved in. We see some notable examples of that in Poland. Professor Kański talked about that this morning, and one could others are much more qualified than I to give precise details in which of events in which invocation of international norms has played a real role in helping to shape specific political or judicial instruments and provisions that would help to make these rights more fully realized. Now, that brings us back to the problem of enforcement. And here I would say the international machinery is indeed most efficient. There's no real effort to provide for that in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There was, of course, an awareness that this was a deficiency, and a process began immediately to draft treaties. It was first thought of it would be one covenant, then it has since become two covenants on international human rights, one on civil and political rights, the other one on economic, social, and cultural rights. It took another 18 years for those to be drafted in a form that could be accepted by the General Assembly. It took another 10 years before they had enough parties to go into force. The enforcement machinery there is important, but it still remains quite weak. I think the best hope for real enforcement machinery and real realization of international human rights standards comes through the process by which these norms are transplanted or absorbed in a variety of ways, with some variations, into domestic legal systems. And the challenge now is to help find ways to make that more real, either by processes of judicial review, some hopeful beginning signs of that in Poland, again, as were described this morning, and also through the development of truly representative institutions that may be more sensitive to those kinds of concerns. Thank you.
David, thank you. I think you can see that in opening this topic up for discussion this afternoon that we have an uncommonly rich tapestry in which comparativism runs not only from one country to another in the obvious sense of crossing national boundaries, but it's an edifice of many stories as well. We within this country are increasingly aware of the way in which developments at the state constitutional level influence the federal and vice versa. Within a federal system, we have what Justice Louis Brandeis once referred to as 50 state laboratories. And our state courts, interestingly enough, for those who follow these things, are being rather creative in building bodies of constitutional law and individual rights quite beyond what the U.S. Supreme Court has done in federal constitutional opinions. The remarks that we've had from Professors Lilick and Martin suggest the enterprise internationally is more than simply the traditional 18th century question of borrowing from one country and adapting to another, but in fact norms at different levels within this country, state and federal, but internationally from national to international kinds of tribunals. Those who anticipate 1992 in Europe, for example, are beginning to think through some very interesting jurisprudential questions of whether the taking down of economic barriers connotes as well a single set of rights which would apply the same everywhere, the same problem we in this country have wrestled with domestically for a long time. It's very rich, as I say, and I'm grateful to both of my colleagues for the contributions they've made. I do want to be democratic. We don't have but so much time, and I hope with their permission, unless either of them feels compelled to attack the other at this point. I think the he has not read all of his pages yet. Of course, I have to say that most of them are blank pages, so you really you don't have to worry. And I've scribbled a note in there.
My research assistant let me down.
I've scribbled there ad lib, you son of a bitch. that is my handwriting. So if I may, let me turn now to questions or comments from those who are present. Apparently, for this to be picked up in the other room and also here in the transcription, I have to point these two microphones at you. They're not loaded. Don't worry. But I'll point them in your direction, and it would be helpful if you would, in raising a question, give your name and some affiliation, and then put the question to any of us or all of us as you see fit. Or make a statement if you like.
May we hear from Mr. Lansky on the fullest aspect of this?
Would you like to lead off with a comment or two? That would be very appropriate. Thank you. Let me pass that across.
Thank you. I would like to make some comment, maybe not from the Polish perspective, but from the perspective of myself as a student of American approach to human rights issue. I have studied those issues, in my opinion, quite thoroughly, and have some comments. Professor Lilich very modestly talked about the impact of the American law on the international human rights law. I would say that that impact could be found in the right size only if we go through all materials relating to the preparation of international documents. And then we would found that American delegations were always among them those who forced both the most provisions of Universal Declaration and then the International Covenant on Political and Civil Rights and several other international documents. So I would say that looking into maybe not final texts, because final texts were results of compromises that had to be done just in order to conclude those agreements, but looking into the process of negotiating those, one can find many fields where impact of the American legal thoughts was expressed. But unfortunately, the United States government's approach was not consequent one. After signing, those instruments were abandoned by the government and could not be ratified. Then an interesting issue was raised in Professor Lilly's contribution on the efforts of United States courts to use international human rights law. I think that the first efforts should be mentioned here. I mean the unsuccessful Sei Fuji case when United Nations Charter was invoked for the first time, and when the United States courts wanted to base judgment on grounds of Article 55 and 56 of the Charter of the United Nations. And the last achievement are those cases where some, not all, American courts would like to use international human rights law indirectly, because to my mind we can say about indirect use in case if it is not ratified by, but was instead the construction of treating them as customary international law was introduced, and which was seen in Filartiga and Wilkinson cases concerning the detention and inhuman and cruel treatment. I think that the United States contributed also to some new notions. I would like to show an example of right to privacy, which is an American invention and which was exported all over the world, also through International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. It is it seems to be more American than English invention, and was taken as such by many European and Asian and African countries and put sometimes into their constitutions, or sometimes they were recognized as such as rights by ordinary courts, even without constitutional basis. In the practice of our Supreme Court, I can at least point one opinion where judges found the right to privacy among the basic values that should be protected under the civil law. However, one would not be able to show the article of the Constitution that was appropriate for such statement. So, in my opinion, there is a process of borrowing from ideas, and borrowing rather from ideas than by taking whole parts of the body of law. It happened only in late 50s and early 60s that the Universal Declaration was imported that way by many African, especially African countries. I made such study about the impact of Universal Declaration on the constitutional law of several countries, and I found that especially African countries in late 50s and beginning of 60s invoked those declarations, but after that one could not find it. It was abandoned just by the constitutionalists of these countries. In 50s, the fascination of Universal Declaration was visible also in some European countries, where court decisions were made were rendered on the base of Universal Declaration in Italy or in Belgium, in France, even after European Convention was ratified by these countries, which is very interesting and difficult to be understood situation. Anyway, I would say that that impact is multi-sided, and it's very difficult to trace it unless we stop at the very general consideration that we say that there is exchange of ideas, which is now even more complex than was in 18th century, because we lawyers can exchange our ideas, and it's difficult to say when you, three of you, influence my mind to that extent that I will suggest in a few weeks or in 1 year or 2 years some solutions, just not being conscious that that was under that influence. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that contribution. I'm curious to know I was just going to ask if our other Polish colleagues to my left might have an additional comment or two. So if I hope this will reach. May I pass it down?
I'm Leszek Garlicki from the University of Warsaw. And first of all, I'd like to assure my friend Kaniski that I will correct all your wrong assumptions about civil rights back in Poland. It was very
wrong.
I think it's not necessary to say that all these interventions were very, very interesting. We just got, at least today, to very good speeches. So just let me have three short comments. My first comment. I think each modern constitution is composed at least of three parts: state machinery, human rights, and mechanism of enforcement of the protection of the constitution. And now if we look into the patterns of influence of American constitution, it's very difficult to find the influence of the state machinery part of the American constitution. In some countries, there were attempts to adopt some kind of presidentialism or some kind of other American experiences. But at least as far as Europe is concerned, it was usually completely mistaken, and it simply didn't work. Why? I think most of all because there is a completely different system of political parties and completely different system of this political ways of government in America and in most European countries. Well, the second part of each modern constitution is the enforcement part, and I tried yesterday to prove that this American idea of judicial review is today perhaps the most successful export of American constitutionalism. And now the third part, the human rights. Once again, in my opinion, it's one of these very successful elements of American constitutionalism all over the world. Now, the question is why? I suppose, and perhaps might be invoked here, is the problem of some general values, the problem of natural law values. It is perhaps not accepted by American jurisprudence, or it is not accepted by American courts, but at least in my opinion, a lot of decisions of American courts are in reality based on some natural law ideas, even if it is coded by the general names like due process of law, equal protection, etc. Well, my second comment is that it's not that it's possible to indicate, let's say, a negative influence of American human rights approach on the constitutionalism in other countries. Well, the traditional way of critics of American individual or civil rights system was it's not sufficient. Well, there are some provision concerning individual rights, there are personal rights, there are some provision which deals with political rights, but there's nothing about economic, social rights, etc., etc. Hence, it's an old-fashioned approach. Now, in the end of the 20th century, we have to look for something new. And in my opinion, the developments from the late 40s, when this criticism was formulated, the developments has proved that this criticism was wrong, that it is just impossible to put the same constitutional value to personal and political rights, human rights, from the one side, and economic and social rights from the other side, because it's a problem of enforcement. And it is impossible to enforce economic and social rights if the social and economic context of a given country doesn't allow to do it. So what was the outcome of it? The outcome was some very sneaky jurisprudence of some constitutional courts. Let's say the French Constitutional Council. They said, well, there are some rights of second category. Okay, what does mean second category? Strict construction, etc. For example, rights of property. The Spanish Constitutional Court. He said, well, there are some rights which are not very clearly enforceable before the Constitutional Court, at least by the way of individual complaint of a citizen. So perhaps it's possible to say today that this negative American influence is just to prove that another standard should be attached to political and personal rights. And still much more cautious approach should be attached to economic, social, cultural rights. That's something very interesting, but still not so easy enforceable. And my third comment is that it's perhaps a paradoxal. But if somebody would read American Bill of Rights, he would be probably very disappointed. Because there are not too much text in the Bill of Rights. So it's rather the American jurisprudence, it's rather the decision of the Supreme Court which created this real American human rights system. Now, the system was translated under very big American influence into different international instruments. It has been perhaps also translated into some other constitutions. But once again, it's for me this impact of American constitutional ideas and not of just the letter of American Constitution. Thank you.
Hubert, would you like to add any comments?
I should like to make only one comment. One comment which may be of some importance. And it is a question which in law is unfortunately relatively important. That means linguistic problem. The problem is that it is, as far as I know, only English language which have a notion, a concept of right as something different from law. Because in every European country, language, in French, in German, and so on, it's there is no such a distinction. So you have to distinguish in many European continental, let's say so, languages between objective and subjective law. And subjective law means approximately the same than as a right in English. And this is the problem which sometimes may be very important, because the human rights conception is very deeply anchored not only in the English and American history, but it also is deeply rooted in language. And language is a very important tool to introduce something to the intellectual heritage. So the problems of transplants of the American civil rights or human rights system into other countries, even into European continental countries, is clamped down to a certain extent by this linguistic problem. After 1945, there is really a much better knowledge of English than before, and I think that that also, thanks to it, the impact of this American conception of human rights is now much greater than ever before.
Thank you. Victor, I think you had asked to be recognized.
My name is Viktor Oshatinsky. I'm from Warsaw, and my last academic association was with the University of Virginia. And when Hubert was talking about the right and law, I just realized that English is also the only language in which there are two different words for the verb to drink and to drink beer. In every other language, that's the same word for drink and beer. But some linguists explained to me that drink and beer also has some common root. Anyway, but I think that these linguistic things are important, and they really shape our way we think about rights and about especially what is inherent in law as a right, as a way of claiming, simply. I believe that if I say that I have a right, it means that I can claim, and I think that that's extremely important. And probably this claim is included in the European word law. But I want just to comment a little bit on the American influence and the influence of American Constitution. And I want to begin with Professor Howard said about the lack of influence in the 19th century. More so, in the 19th century in Europe, American Constitution was extremely fiercely criticized and attacked, especially for its conservative interpretation by the Supreme Court, because, as I tried to mention yesterday, the American constitutional concepts were completely unable to solve or to contribute to the solution of the social problems in completely different social context of the European countries. And I think that this was very important, and I will get very soon to what happened after 1945, that in some countries American mechanisms began to work. But I want to stop for a second about 1919. Because we used to go over that very easily, but there was a clear attempt to introduce American mechanisms, and more precisely individual rights, to solve some European problems, and it was a disaster. It was in the Versailles Peace Conference when President Wilson, frightened by the prospects of anti-Semitism in Romania and Poland and other mistreatment of minorities in Central Europe, insisted that there will be provisions to protect the minorities by the means of individual rights. Now, that's very interesting because that's a rare example in human history when two American mechanisms clashed as a means to the same objective. Most of Europeans at that time suggested that the better idea or better vehicle to protect minorities in Europe will be American also idea of federalism in a sense of autonomy, national autonomy and national federation in Central European countries, that each minority group would have their own autonomy and representatives in a form of national, not territorial, federal state. President Wilson, however, shared what was at that time common belief in the United States. Perhaps it was false, but at that time it was shared in the American concept of melting pot. He believed that melting pot functioned very well in America, and therefore he thought that if the individual minorities will be given individual right protections in Central European countries, then they will eventually merge into one nation. And he expressed that in several of his speeches and in writing, and American representatives were making this claim also in Versailles. And the minority treaties were giving this protection, but that was to disregard or not taking into consideration strongly enough the fact that the very word nation has always meant something completely different in Europe and in the United States. And the European nation has basically different character than American nation. It was formed in different way. And of course, there was very difficult to melt it only giving the protection of individual rights. And as history proved, this protection was not strong enough and very soon became useless. However, I want to point that this was the vehicle through which the very notion of individual rights came to the Central European constitutions after World War I. The second thing which I want to comment is after 1945. And of course, the Universal Declaration, very important to understand that it was shaped under American influence. And many countries adopted this declaration. And we know that in some countries it was respected, in many other, majority perhaps, it was not. So I don't want to get into the functioning of the declaration, but I want to make an attempt at defining some social conditions which prevented or facilitated the positive influence of the American mechanisms in the world. And I studied the four countries which adopted sort of American-like constitution after World War II, namely Germany, Japan. In Japan, the constitution was written. Japanese constitution was literally written by 10 American officers, lawyers, none of them constitutional lawyer, none of them specialists in Japan, in a period of 1 week. They got an order to do that in 10 days. They were good soldiers. They wrote it in 1 week. And this constitution functioned relatively well for last over 40 years. There two other countries where the American-like constitution was adopted were, as you mentioned, Philippines and South Korea. Now, you see, interesting thing. In two of these countries, American mechanisms, and I'm talking in the case of Germany of the mechanism of human rights rather than machinery of the government, American mechanisms worked relatively well. In two other countries, they failed. In two other countries, they failed to change an extremely elitist and abusive government, in both cases of the South Korea and Philippines. But if you look at these four countries, you will see some underlying social pattern. Two countries in which these mechanisms turned out to work were the countries which were defeated by the West and the United States and occupied by the United States. Two other countries were the countries which were allied with the United States, and the United States came there to the friendly but extremely corrupt, elitist, feudal or post-feudal government, and they could not influence that much friendly post-feudal government as they could have changed the government and the social structure of Germany and Japan. And I don't want to get into the details of the immense social revolution which took place in the West Germany and Japan under American influence under 1945. Let me state my thesis. I have a thesis that there are two preconditions of the positive influence of American constitutional mechanisms in modern world. One has to do with the changes in the world and one with the situation and changes in the United States. The first one, the American mechanism can work relatively well in those countries in which feudal and post-feudal elites has been abolished by internal process of social revolution. And that explains to me why American mechanisms were almost useless in Poland before the war. Of course, they were seemingly useless in Poland in 1945, but they are becoming more and more useful in Poland in 1980. But the prerequisite I am mentioning, which took place in Japan, in Germany, smashing and abolishing feudal and post-feudal elites, has been fulfilled in all of these countries. The second prerequisite, in my opinion, had to do with something very important inside the United States. American concept of freedom was useless in the world in the 19th century because it was a concept of freedom from government. And the world, besides America, needed the concept of freedom through government. What happened in the United States in the 30s was the enlargement of American concept of freedom with some acceptance of the concept of freedom through government. And it was absolutely not by chance that it was a bunch of new dealers who went to Germany and to Japan to introduce the social reforms in these countries. Today, America is getting back to its original concept of freedom from government, for better or worse. It's not me to judge. Perhaps it's for much better for America. But I am afraid that at the same time, America may once again preclude or make more difficult its impact in the world with what may be very healthy and very useful for you. And my last comment. Now, all my studies on America and the rest of the world prove to me that this is not a different country. And not only for a Pole, but for someone who comes from Canada, it's a different continent. It's a different planet. And I believe that the difference between this planet and the rest of the world can be metaphorically stated in the difference between the organism and the colony of cells. I believe that all the rest of the world are organisms in which a cell cannot survive alone, in which a cell has to have some limitations to contribute to the rest, but also can benefit from the rest. And I believe that this planet is a colony of cells in which individuals at least think that they can survive alone, and they just gather because it's more useful and it's perhaps better. And I think that that also involves this difference in the concepts of freedom and the possible influence. Thank you.
John, I think you had asked to be recognized.
Yes, thank you.
My name is John Rensenbrink. I'm from Bowdoin College. Listening to you, David DeMartin, and then also to Victor just now, I want to raise an issue about torture. Albert Camus, the French philosopher and novelist, once said that the 20th century is the century of the total assault on the individual. And I think he meant the integrity of the human being. And I think he had in mind there in that context also specifically the physical human being. Not thinking only of, and one could apply this not only to the fate of the Jews and the Holocaust, and not only to the slave camps that Stalin set up, in which masses of people were indiscriminately destroyed, or all the Polish officers at one fell swoop at Katyn. That kind of behavior. Not only that, but also since the Second World War, to the mounting degree to which governments around the world have resorted to torture at the drop of a hat. I'm told that even in some Latin American countries, they would farm out the torturing to private companies. And I wonder if in this century, and looking at the next century, David, whether or not, and I certainly do agree with you, the way you formulated the problems, very, very well seen, and also the formulation of the solution in some ways, that it takes time. But whether or not there can be some greater identification of priorities in terms of human rights. We've had, as you indicated, civil and political statements and declarations. We've had social, economic, and cultural statements and so forth. We've had lots and lots of talk and lots of palaver around the world at many conferences about human rights. But I don't believe that we have really sufficiently singled out a couple of things. One is the priority. And I'm advancing here the thesis that a priority here is the protection of individual person's physical being. I think the feminist movement is also raising that issue with respect to rape. And I'm wondering whether or not, in terms of suddenly finding those priorities, whether legal scholars and at conventions and conferences of this kind, that's why I'm raising this, to ask whether we should not raise our own consciousness about, first, the need for setting priorities, and secondly, for identifying whether or not that priority I'm talking about is not such an absolutely fundamental priority, which is recklessly disregarded by most governments in the world. And it focuses to a large degree, you have been at work with Amnesty International, as I understand, and they have done such remarkable work on this whole issue of torturing. And so I'm wondering whether setting the priorities, whether that priority is not important, and then whether there are, perhaps, in the context of today's discussion, when you speak about American emphasis, for example, the right to privacy that you applied to Zimbabwe, for example, whether those kinds of legal developments and prescriptions could not be evolved and made into significant international instruments that would set some basis for some teeth in this specific area, so that we don't have to wait too long.
Let's take one. I'm going to take one more comment. We started about 15 minutes late. I'm trespassing on everyone's time by going over about 15 minutes. We're almost out of time. We'll take one more comment and then ask if either of my colleagues wants to make any final either response to questions or other statement.
I am Harry Diston, non-academic, businessman, author, horseman, one-time soldier, and long ago a scholar of sorts. I am not concerned so much with the enforcement of human rights, but rather the current trend. I think it's unwarranted. I think it's undesirable, and it may be very dangerous, of an expansion and extension of the term rights. It expresses itself in our country, I doubt whether it is anywhere else, but in our country in any way, in three major items and some more related to them. One is that the incompetent should have all the rights, if you want to call it that, of material advantages, benefits, cultural, and actually just material, as the competent do. Another one is that they confuse equality with equal opportunity, and people never were equal, they aren't now, and they never will be. I am strong for equal opportunity, but I resent any, object to any idea of equality. And the other one, which like unto it, that the minority should have the rights of the majority, if not more, as it now turns out, as you know, we're all concerned with reverse discrimination. Now, I believe that anybody would support and admire the concept of a good state looking after its indigent, its disadvantaged, its poor, and whatnot. That is an obligation of a good state. I think everybody would admire and support. Incidentally, when you say we aren't, military officers have to swear that they will uphold and preserve the Constitution of the United States, not the president, not the country, but the Constitution, which is interesting, and the Bill of Rights and many of its subsequent amendments. And my point is, with all we've been saying about human rights, nobody seems to be concerned much about the misuse of the term rights. You mentioned, Dick Howard, that these terms have subjective implications that we don't have. So I'm just raising the point, should we not be concerned with that aspect of rights?
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to now go to David Martin for any final comment he may wish to make, and then to Richard Lilick, and then I'll conclude the session.
I want to respond primarily to John Rensenbrink's statements. I guess I should say initially, perhaps ironically, there's a certain kinship between the last two comments, although I have the feeling that they might come out very differently in their own particular priorities of which rights should be attended to. There is a real risk that the language of rights will be overused. I'm concerned about some of my friends in the human rights community who so readily adopt the notion of a third generation and perhaps a fourth generation and more proliferating generations of rights, so that almost anything that is good and desirable comes to be spoken of in the language of rights. I very much share your point of view that we need to have a sense of priorities, and I would agree that rights to personal integrity or personal security probably rank highest. One of the things I admire most about Amnesty International is that in the midst of great pressures throughout the human rights community to climb aboard every good cause that comes along, and they are good causes and they are appealing, Amnesty has resisted and said our business is primarily to deal with rights of personal integrity. That is what we will focus on. That's what we will attend to, and they do focus on that. So the dual distinction often used between civil and political rights on the one hand and economic, social, and cultural rights on the other probably should be a threefold distinction. It is one we used in the State Department about 10 years ago. Rights of personal integrity, then other civil and political rights, then economic, social, and cultural rights, and others could add more. I think it is important to add that. Now, but there's a countervailing danger, and Professor Galitsky's comments suggested this to me. We so often tend to link up the notion of rights with judicial review, at least in America, with judicial review as an effective enforcement mechanism. And I think there is a certain wisdom to that and a certain effectiveness, a way in which we ought to link those up. But we risk losing sight of other goods as well. This is maybe paradoxically the opposite problem from the one I was suggesting before. We risk losing sight of other good and important things to work for. Maybe we shouldn't call them rights, but it is important to work, including through government, but also through private and voluntary efforts, for other kinds of goods. Items that we ought also to be able to work for, at least domestically. Internationally, perhaps a priority on rights of personal security. Domestically, we really ought to find ways to work for other kinds of important ends.
Professor Lilick.
Well, I'd just like to make two brief points. First, I reaffirm everything that David has just said. There is a interesting confluence between General Dinstan's point about rights and the expansion of rights and the questions about priorities of rights. Here I take a position which frankly makes me the subject of much criticism by my colleagues, particularly in the Third World and in Eastern Europe, namely that I think at least when we're talking about international human rights, we ought to in effect domesticate and masticate those rights that we have before the core rights we have before we go about adopting other third or fourth generation rights, as David said and as I alluded to in my remarks. Unfortunately, at least in my estimation, this is not the trend. The Paris conference to which Mr. Howard mentioned a few minutes ago, I was at that conference too, and of course was roundly criticized by all French leftist lawyers and your Supreme Court justice from Poland and a variety of Third World people. the whole emphasis there was on universality, which is not universality with what I think we would be talking about today, but universality in including everything as a right, and indeed as an international human right. And there's a conference in Strasbourg next week in which some of the same cast of characters have been invited, so that the European restriction, or what has been a restriction on civil and political rights, is apparently under some pressure as well. So I think that, as in all good constitution building and all good lawyering, one should focus upon those key important rights and make sure that they are effectively implemented before going on and talking about things like disarmament and peace and what have you, which do get into major geopolitical things that I think are well beyond the capacity of most domestic legal systems and, of course, most international human rights bodies to handle. And it's fair to say, of course, as we all know, that much of this discussion in the international bodies is created by people who are really against international human rights, and they know that the more you discuss peace and disarmament and a variety of underlying problems for terrorism, what have you, the less time and less resources that you have to devote to what I think should be focused upon. With respect to the priority of rights, I'd just like to say that there is, of course, a built-in, at least insofar as international human rights law is concerned, there's a built-in priority of rights. Those are the rights in the civil and political covenant that are not derogable, that even in a state of an emergency, a state cannot say are not the rules of the game to be followed. And I adhere to that. Those are the basic rights of personal freedom, of course, the core rights, freedom from government interference, the right of free, well, even the right of free expression can be restricted actually in states of emergency, so that perhaps is not the best example, but certainly prohibitions against arbitrary detention, prohibitions against torture and other interference with personal personal values. I think that's well understood, and I think it's like amnesty, focusing upon a narrow issue of rights is the thing to do. Finally, just let me make one last point, because the question of privacy was raised as an example where the United States constitutional law has contributed a lot. That certainly is true. Starting from Brandeis and Warren in their article, it has become U.S. constitutional law. And, of course, we see this with respect to the abortion case will be argued later this month. But my example in the last three pages of how the United States is getting out of step actually is a classic example, because the United States, insofar as the rights of homosexuals are concerned, in Bowers against Hardwick 3 years ago, upheld, the Supreme Court upheld, by a 5-4 vote, Georgia statute that made criminal acts between consenting adults, whereas the year before that decision, by a vote of 15-4, the European Court of Human Rights had indicated that this was a right of privacy that we have transplanted into the European system, and yet we don't accept right now. And I have an interesting quotation here to read from Mr. Lester, because he quotes a few of the statements that Chief Justice Berger made in his concurring opinion. He said, to hold that the act of homosexual sodomy is somehow protected as a fundamental right would be to cast aside millennia of moral teaching. And he went on to indicate, of course, a complete unawareness that that moral teaching apparently had been cast aside by the European Court in October of 1981. Other justices said the same thing. They rejected the argument that there are any rights between consenting adults on the homosexual level, as the claim was made that this was inherent in a concept of ordered liberty, and Justice White said that's a facetious argument, not even worthy of consideration at all. Well, it just so happens that that case was not very adequately briefed by the attorneys in Georgia. Certainly they had no awareness of the international dimensions of the problem and of the decisions of the European Court. But increasingly the Supreme Court is being confronted with those arguments, as I indicated in the Thompson case, and I would hope that we might be able to benefit and engage in this two-way trade of basic human rights.
Thank you, Richard and David. Let me make a last comment, and that is that if you were to go into a library, say at the University of Virginia, and pull out a 19th century textbook on constitutions of whatever kind, the chances are it would be a very traditional, rather sterile comparison of texts. Constitutional law in its comparative form, if it existed, basically was laying documents alongside of each other and showing what they had to say. It's clear to me that the discussion of the last 3 days drives home the extent to which constitutionalism is no longer simply documentary or textual comparisons, but a far broader study than it ever used to be. And I think perhaps among the American contributions might be the centrality of interpretation. That is to say that taking constitutions out of the scholar's desk and putting it into the laps of courts, the rise of the constitutional court as a vehicle, the rise of judicial opinions and the modes of their being used by the Indian Supreme Court or the Court of Zimbabwe or the U.S. Supreme Court or whatever, makes one realize the extent to which the texture of constitutional law is so much beyond the document. We in this country are very familiar with how a judge can take two or three words, cruel and unusual punishment, equal protection of the laws, due process of law, and tease an extraordinary amount of meaning out of those words, meaning of a kind that the framers of that language probably might well be surprised at, like or not like, but certainly might find rather amazing. I'm sure the same sort of process is increasingly going on in other countries. And one reason why I think we find so much more traffic of that kind is something we have not really talked about and obviously will not have time to talk about today, and that is technology. The traffic of the 18th century to which we've alluded was above all the traffic of a handful of well-educated people, the people who could have in their library Rousseau and Locke and Hobbes and the other philosophers of the time. Today, one need not be that elite to have some access to, if not constitutional law in its formal sense, at least those things which I call constitutionalism. I will be leaving, as I mentioned the other day, in about 10 days for Budapest, where the Hungarians are at work on a new constitution. I don't propose to give any advice. I mean, I certainly eschew any role of coming as a revisor or consultant or authority of any kind. I really go more to learn than I go to teach. But it's clear that in Budapest, they are not only close to Vienna, but they're close to the whole civilized world. They cannot be unaware of things happening around the globe, and national frontiers are simply too porous in this day and age for ideas not to cross those boundaries. And ordinary people can talk about them in a way that perhaps ordinary people might not have done 200 years ago. It's a very exciting thing, I think, and of course it can be unleashed in ways that are unpredictable. Obviously, those people in Budapest are concerned, as others of us are, that things might move too well, too fast, too quickly, and provoke a kind of counter-reaction to it. But assuming that one can cabin the instinct to do too much too quickly, extraordinary change, I think, will come about. Well, all we've done these last 3 days, I think, is simply compose something of a very challenging agenda. I'm thinking, in Virginia, we love to celebrate anniversaries. This state is giving to recalling benchmarks, dates of all kinds. We are an old commonwealth, by American standards at least. And I'm thinking ahead to the fact that in 1991, we in America will celebrate the bicentennial of the adoption or the ratification of the Bill of Rights to the U.S. Constitution. In Warsaw, you, of course, in May of that year, will be celebrating the 200th anniversary of the first Polish constitution. The French will be celebrating the bicentennial of their first constitution. I can't speak for the French because they're not well represented this afternoon, but Poles and Americans are, so I propose today that give us 18 months to think about it. We should all get back together and see what we then think of the questions that we've raised today. And I especially, as one of the Americans here, want to thank our friends who've come from Poland to join us. You've really added enormously to our understanding of what constitutionalism means, and I'm sure others here would like to join me in a round of applause and thanks to everybody.